This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
On our current path, by the end of this century, Earth could warm over 4 degrees C, way past the danger point. We know that from ingenious work out of Carnegie Institution for Science at Stanford University. Dr. Patrick T. Brown is the lead author of the new paper in Nature, along with his co-author Ken Caldera. The paper is setting a fire in science. I've talked to several scientists about it already. It's only been out a couple of days. It's very bad news about our future unless we slash emissions fast. Patrick is a postdoctoral research scientist. Since getting his doctorate in 2016, he's published 7 refereed scientific papers. Patrick is also a contributor to the fact-checking website Climate Feedback. Patrick Brown, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
It's important to get this new science out through nonprofit radio, so let's get to it. In 2016, you wrote an article in Physics Today explaining how different views of the same facts could provide more or less sensational headlines. How is this for a sensational headline from the usually reliable MIT Technology Review? It says, a new study based on satellite observations finds that temperatures could rise nearly 5 degrees C by the end of this century. Patrick, can we find that in your new paper in Nature?
Yeah, you can find that. The issue there, though, is that that assumes a given increase in greenhouse gases from humans. And so humans still have the choices to make. So humans can emit less greenhouse gases, and then that those numbers would come down. So our results are, for a given increase in greenhouse gases, this is what we would expect in terms of temperature. But we're not saying anything about we're not trying to predict the future of how technology and how human decisions will progress over the next century. So that's where the real changes can come in.
What drove you and Ken to do this research?
Well, this has just been a longstanding question in climate science of, for a given increase in greenhouse gases, how much warming do we expect? And it's been a stubbornly large range for a long time. And so that's why it was something that we were interested in looking at. And so we have these new observations that are just kind of coming to maturity over the past 10 to 15 years. So now we have 15 years of really good satellite data, which is kind of just starting to get long enough to get robust statistics on these types of things. And so we wanted to use that to see if we could really discriminate between the well and poor performing models, and then see if the better models projected a different amount of warming in the future than the average model. And so what we found is that the models that are doing the best in simulating the recent past, where we have good observations, are the models that tend to simulate more warming in the future.
For many of us, the crash of sea ice in 2007 came as a shock. Was that projected by climate models at the time?
Well, not explicitly, but you can expect models to predict year-to-year variability like that. You can only expect them to predict long-term trends. So like the fact that sea ice crashed in 2007 rather than 2010 or 2005, that's something that's just kind of random and has to do with just the chaotic nature of the climate system. And it's not something that any climate model will ever be able to project. But climate models in general do show this long-term decrease in Arctic sea ice. And that is something that we have seen in observations as well.
But it does suggest that there could be other big surprises that models don't see.
Absolutely. There could definitely be tipping points in the climate system that could come about in a very short amount of time and be a big surprise to climate scientists.
Do we know why some models are working better than others?
Well, that's something that our research is trying to address. So most of the range in future warming comes from the way that models treat clouds. Clouds are very difficult to model, and there's a lot of uncertainty in terms of how clouds will change as the Earth gets warmer. So some models say that as the Earth gets warmer, there'll be less cloud coverage, and so that will reflect less solar radiation back to space, which would mean we'll absorb more of that sunlight, and that would cause further warming. So that would be a positive cloud feedback. Where some models suggest that as the Earth gets warmer, cloud coverage will actually increase, and that will reflect more of the sun's energy back to space, and so that would cancel out some of the warming. And so what we're finding is that the models that project this positive feedback, not positive in the normative sense, but positive as in it amplifies the initial warming, models that produce this positive cloud feedback are the ones that are doing the best in the in simulating the recent past. And so it seems like they are simulating the clouds the best over the time period when we have observations. And so there's reason to believe that their simulation of cloud feedback in the future will also be the best.
So there has been a difference in projections, and let's be clear about the models you're assessing. Are we talking about the best coupled models, the most complicated, the best we have internationally?
Yes, there's about 30 or 40 global climate models that are produced by different organizations all around the world, and they are the state-of-the-art, cutting-edge models in terms of simulating the entire Earth's climate system.
Some people have accused the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change as erring on the side of caution, and of course they do have to report to governments. Has the IPCC picked very conservative models?
No, not in my estimation. I think the IPCC has done a very fair survey of the literature. So one thing that they are doing, though, is that they're basically adhering to this principle of kind of model democracy. So if you develop a model and it's, you know, it meets the standards and then it gets submitted to these kind of data archives, that will be included in the IPCC. And there's no kind of discrimination between models that are performing well and models that are not performing so well. So that's something that our research is attempting to do. But I wouldn't say that the IPCC has intentionally erred on the side of caution. I think it's a very fair survey of the literature.
And you begin in the paper by naming two great sources of uncertainty in these models, and maybe you've already discussed one of them, which is what are humans going to do and what will our emissions be, but what are the other uncertainties that you looked at?
Yeah, so that's the first uncertainty is what are humans going to do, and then the kind of the second line of uncertainty is there's carbon cycle feedback uncertainties, so that humans might increase greenhouse gases, and then that could cause further increases in greenhouse gases. That's another thing that we didn't really look at. So our study was just on this issue of if you define ahead of time how much increase in greenhouse gases that you're supposing will happen in the future, then how much temperature change do you get? And so that uncertainty is what we're looking at. And that uncertainty has a lot to do with clouds. And so, as I mentioned, it's the models that are simulating the clouds the best in the recent past tend to simulate more warming in the future. And we think that we can narrow that uncertainty using our statistical analysis.
And what about climate sensitivity? Are you including that as a response uncertainty?
Yeah, so we explicitly, the majority of our results are for these future greenhouse gas concentration pathways. But we also do look at climate sensitivity itself. And so our results say that the raw model mean, if you just throw all the models together and average them, climate sensitivity, which is the amount of warming you get for doubling CO2 concentrations and then allowing the climate system to equilibrate, the amount of warming that you get for all the models, if you just average them together, is 3.1 degrees Celsius. And our results, combining information from models and observations, suggests an equilibrium climate sensitivity of 3.7 degrees Celsius.
I've heard Dr. James Hansen talk about Earth's radiative energy budget. How would you explain that for the ordinary person? Because I think it's important that we get what that's about in order to understand your paper.
Basically, if you're thinking about temperature is more or less a measure of energy. And the energy for the climate system comes from the sun. And it's just kind of a basic accounting. We call it a budget, just like a family budget, where you have flows of energy coming in from the sun, so light coming in from the sun. But part of that energy is not absorbed by the Earth system. It's reflected back to space right away by things like clouds or things like ice and snow on the surface of the planet. And so you would have kind of a positive flow coming in from the sun, and then you would subtract out what's reflected back to space, similar to income and expenditure in a budget. And then the other big component of the budget is that the Earth itself is emitting radiation to space. So it's just like light, except it's at a longer wavelength, and so it's sometimes called heat radiation or infrared radiation or long wave radiation. But the Earth is emitting that to space, and that also interacts with clouds and with these greenhouse gases in our atmosphere. And so you have to do the accounting on the energy flows over there as well. But fundamentally, temperature, the temperature of the planet, and then temperature change of the planet has to do with how these energy flows change in the Earth's climate system. So it's the whole global warming scientific issue is all about the Earth's energy budget.
And what comes back from the satellites that you were able to use to get a grasp on what's happening now?
Yeah, so we're looking at, we're using this instrument called the Ceres, or it's not an instrument, it's really just a system because it's on multiple satellites. But it's an instrument that's looking at the radiation coming back from the Earth to space. So it can sample both the reflected shortwave radiation coming back, so the sun's light reflected back to space, and I can also see the heat radiation or the infrared radiation. And so that satellite has allowed us to basically constrain what the Earth's energy budget is over this time period, at least starting in around 2001. And before that, we had some less reliable estimates. And then before the 70s, before there were satellites, it was extremely difficult to know anything about what the Earth's energy budget was doing on a year-to-year or decade-to-decade basis.
Patrick, just out of curiosity, did your internships with NASA help you understand what is possible with satellites?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I was at JPL for 2 summers, and they are kind of at the center of this Earth system observation area. And so being exposed to many seminars and many other scientists' work there has absolutely helped me understand how we can best use these satellites to understand our climate system better.
I find in the paper's discussion on physical mechanisms, you mentioned, quote, the efficiency by which energy is distributed to the deeper layers of the ocean. How important is that to our overall picture of the coming climate, and do we really understand that variable fully?
Yeah, so that's kind of a throwaway line in the paper, because we don't explicitly look at that aspect of it in our paper. But that is very important, because the Earth's heat capacity is mostly in the ocean. And depending on how much of the ocean is available to absorb that heat, that will matter a lot in terms of how much warming you get for a given increase in greenhouse gases. So if most of the heat is absorbed in the upper layers of the ocean and stays there, that's bad news for people living on the surface of the planet, like everyone, because we're very close to that heat. However, if the ocean is able to distribute that heat to depth more readily, that would mean that less heat would be staying at the surface where we live. And so you'd expect less warming there, and then, of course, less negative impacts that are projected. So that's a key aspect of the science, and a lot of oceanographers are working on that. We think we have that constrained within a relatively narrow range, such that that new answers are not going to radically change our projections of warming. But that is a key aspect that people are looking at.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. Patrick Brown from the Carnegie Institution at Stanford. We're talking about his new paper in the journal Nature and a climate that may be at the worst end of prediction, depending on how we react to the situation. On a current trajectory of emissions, the business-as-usual RCP 8.5 of the IPCC, what percent chance, Patrick, would an ensemble of major climate models give of going over 4 degrees C mean warming?
So in our results, we show that under the RCP 8.5 scenario, if you just look at the raw models without incorporating observations, there would be about a 62% chance of exceeding 4 degrees Celsius, where when you incorporate information from observations like we're doing, it would be a 93% chance. So upping that chance of going over that threshold, which of course is, you know, twice what the Paris Agreement would have us be looking at. So that is not where we want to be.
I don't like those odds. There were two conferences called Beyond 4 Degrees, and the scientists there thought that at the time that it was unthinkable and maybe unsurvivable. So, yeah, we got to make some changes before we go there.
Right. Based on the literature on impacts, which is not what my study is about, but based on that literature, we do not want to be going down the RCP 8.5 pathway, which is basically a continue to emit more and more greenhouse gases throughout the century pathway.
Now, on your bio page at Carnegie, you like quantifying difficult to quantify things. I tried to follow the formulas in your new paper, and my science isn't good enough. I failed. Can you give us an example of maybe one of the difficult to quantify things that you explored when you were trying to compare the models to reality, let's say?
I would say that the whole practice is trying to quantify a difficult to quantify thing. So we're trying to, in the most complete and best way possible, use our best observations to basically decipher between well and poor performing models. And we think that we did a pretty good job of that. So just to give a specific example of what's going on in our methodology that's attempting to quantify a difficult to quantify thing, we look at, say, the average amount of clouds in a given location and how that relates to warming in the future. So some models simulate more clouds in the current climate system. And those models, in certain locations anyway, those models tend to simulate more warming because they have more clouds that can dissipate in the future. So the more clouds in the current climate system lead to more dissipation, which means to more absorption of solar radiation in the future, and thus more warming. So those types of mechanisms are what are revealed by our study.
Here's another worrying little note from the discussion part of the new paper. You write, a rapid nonlinear melting of the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets has some plausibility, but is not represented in any of the models studied here. So we're not even officially looking at the possible very worst case scenarios.
That's correct. So the starting point for our study is to basically assume that the range of the climate models and the range of the future warming from these climate models is representative of, you know, the possible futures. And we know that's not totally the case because, for example, like I say, none of the models do anything like that in terms of a rapid melting of the Antarctic ice sheet. But if you talk to glaciologists, they would tell you that that is not a possibility that should be totally dismissed, that it's a possibility that should be considered seriously. It's just that in these models, at the current time frame, they're not sophisticated enough to be able to simulate these types of ice sheet dynamics in a very sophisticated manner. So the fact that that's left out from the models means that that is not included in our statistical analysis either. And so that's just a caveat that has to be out there, that we're not really fully sampling all of the range of possibilities that could come in the future.
When I talk to scientists who are optimistic, they're going for the IPCC pathway called RCP 4.5, and that's where we do take some significant actions to reduce emissions relatively quickly. But then you found even that trajectory could give us warming greater than what is in the IPCC reports. Is that right?
Yeah. So for any given trajectory, we basically show more warming than what would be calculated by just using the raw model results, which is what the IPCC does. So it doesn't matter if it's a very, very steep future emissions pathway or a more stringent pathway, we would show that in both cases, we would expect more warming than what has previously been calculated.
I noticed that climate change deniers and some business opportunists demeaned climate models because they didn't correctly capture some parts of reality. Given your research, what happens to that argument?
Yeah, so that's an argument that's made a lot. That people, yeah, say that, well, because climate models don't do a perfect job of simulating the recent past when we have observations to compare them to, that means that we can probably dismiss the most, severe projections of global warming in the future. But our research really turns that on its head, because what we're showing is that the models that do the best in simulating the recent past when we have observations to compare them to, those are the models that actually simulate the most warming in the future, or the most severe projections of global warming. So that means that our results say that if you wanted to kind of throw out the models that are doing the worst, that would mean that you're going to suggest that future warming will be worse than expected, not less severe than expected.
After your research, are you prepared to recommend certain climate models as being the best to be looking at?
I would say that you can potentially look at certain climate models as being the best for a given problem. So climate models do a lot of things other than project global average temperature. So a model that might be better at projecting global average temperature in the future might be worse at projecting sea ice decline, or it might be worse at projecting drought or something like that. So I think you have to, I wouldn't say that there are some models that are just bad. There's just some models that are better at given applications than others.
Are there some things that climate modelers can do now that they've got your paper and this information to improve what they're doing?
Yeah, I think the community has been working on for a long time, and it will continue to work on these cloud parameterizations. And hopefully our paper will point people in the direction of at least the geographic locations where cloud simulations can be improved the most. And thus, that will help improve our projections in the raw model results in the future.
I think this is something that's outside your paper. I know that it is, but it's something we all have to ask ourselves personally. Do you think civilization can survive a 5-degree warming of global mean temperatures by the end of this century?
I, as a physical climate scientist, I will have to just plead ignorance to that question, because that's really, it's really an impacts question. It's really a question of, you know, how crops will be able to weather a warming like that, how ecosystem services would change, how society in general would be able to adapt to that. And those are things that are so far out of my range of expertise that I just feel like that it would just be pure speculation for me to talk about.
Fair enough. I want to ask you, as we wrap up, what do we still need to find out? What are you going to be working on next?
Actually, I am very interested in this question of how, basically what you just brought up, of when we increase the temperature of the planet from emitting greenhouse gases, that has a negative impact on society, which can be measured in, for example, integrated assessment models that incorporate the negative economic impact of that. And then that can be weighed against any potential negative impacts from trying to reduce emissions by essentially making energy more expensive by, you know, forcing the switch to renewable energies, in some cases making energy more expensive, which makes basically everything more expensive. So I think that type of calculation is what's most relevant for informing policy and for looking down the road in terms of human-environment interaction. And so I am very interested in continuing research in that area, where you're looking at human-environment interaction in terms of the global climate and the economy, and how to do that kind of cost-benefit analysis in the best way, such that we can make a future that's kind of the best for everyone.
From California, we've been speaking with Dr. Patrick Brown from the Carnegie Institution for Science at Stanford. He's the lead author of a new paper titled Greater Future Global Warming Inferred from Earth's Recent Energy Budget, as published in the journal Nature, December 7, 2017. Get the links and details in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Patrick, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot. It's been great.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Disappearing ice is a big problem for northern communities, and maybe it's sad when polar bears have no ice for their food to hunt. But what if a shrinking ice cover at the polar sea could reach much further down? What if it drives more drought in California? That's the shocking science news from five scientists at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, and that's located just east of San Francisco. Here is the title: Future Loss of Arctic Sea Ice Cover Could Drive a Substantial Decrease in California's Rainfall. It was published December 5th in the top-ranked journal Nature Communications, just in time for the hugely destructive wildfires again right now in California. We reached the lead author, Ivana Sivanovic, from Lawrence Livermore. Ivana, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me here today. It's very exciting.
Well, it's exciting to have you here, too. Now, I know from looking at your resume that your paper didn't just come out of nowhere. You have been a young scientist who won awards, and you've been the lead author in several years of published works on ice, the Arctic, the atmosphere. What set you searching for long-range influences as far as California?
Well, I think this probably dates back to my PhD studies at Copenhagen in Denmark. There I was working with a group of scientists that were studying signals in Greenland ice cores. And what we saw there is that the changes that were happening in the Arctic were very strongly coupled to changes around pretty much the entire planet. So there was a very strong coupling between tropical proxies, tropical sediment cores, and cave records from around the world. There was a really good agreement between Greenland records and different proxies from really around the planet. So just coming from that background of past climate change, in which you know that Arctic sea ice and Arctic changes can be a really strong push for the atmosphere, it was a really natural continuation then when I started thinking about future climate and how much ice is going to be lost in the future to be interested in whether some of these scenarios can happen in the future too.
Before we dive into just how the Arctic connects to weather so far away, could you please talk to us about the so-called ridiculously resilient ridge that kept California in a terrible drought from 2012 to 2016?
Yes, so because the resilient ridge was basically a region of very high atmospheric pressure, which was parked off the west coast of the United States, up in the North Pacific. And what it did is that it steered the wet tropical air masses northward into Alaska and Canada. So instead of propagating eastwards towards California, that wet winter air went up and brought all the rain to Canada and Alaska and left California very dry. And usually we would, of course, have such ridges, and sometimes they would last a day or two, and sometimes if there was some blocking event, maybe they could last a couple of weeks. But in this case, we basically had that ridge for almost 4 years. And that's why Daniel Swain, a colleague from Stanford University, coined this name, ridiculously resilient ridge, because it just didn't seem to disappear ever.
So now, the link to the Arctic isn't simple. We will need to understand the word teleconnection. And we did talk about that on Radio EcoShock with Dr. Andres Holtz from Portland State University. He told us how changes in Antarctica could affect wildfires in South America, and that was due to teleconnection, he said. So could you please tell us again, what is teleconnection when it comes to atmospheric science?
I mean, it's a very broad term, but it's basically illustration of the fact that changes don't just happen at one place and then stay there, but it happens to change at one location in the planet. Can induce a change in some quite remote location somewhere else, something that you would not expect initially. You would just wonder, oh, why would Greenland be coupled with tropics? Why does tropical rainfall changes in line with temperature changes over in Greenland? So things like that, it almost looks like there's some jump in the atmosphere. Something is jumping from one place to another and inducing change. But actually, these jumps have a lot of science, and things are very connected. But yeah, sometimes it happens that two places have a very extreme reaction versus the location in between those places don't have such a strong reaction. So that's why it looks like a jump, like a teleconnection, like someone phoned from one region to another and told it, oh, why don't you respond now?
It's amazing, isn't it, that the Earth could work that way?
Yeah, it's amazing, and it's beautiful, and in some ways, sometimes it's also smart, so to say, of our planet to do so, because sometimes these teleconnections are means by which, for example, atmosphere can take care of some energy imbalance that happens somewhere else. In these simulations that we performed and studied that I will describe in today's conversation, we saw that imbalance that happens in a high latitude because of the loss of sea ice is compensated for example, in tropical Pacific. So we see a teleconnection between Arctic and tropical Pacific.
The new paper describes a two-step process, and I'd like to take it step by step. So the first is, quote, sea ice changes lead to reorganization of tropical convection. Could you please tell us how that first step works?
So, yeah, I just briefly touched on it just now, but what happens, what we saw in our simulations is that once the ice is lost, then high latitudes emit less energy to space than they used to when we had a larger sea ice extent. And in that sense, like, atmosphere needs to find some other place now to emit that excess energy. And the place where this happens is tropical Pacific. So changes in convection or in cloud cover happen in tropical Pacific in such a way that more outgoing radiation occurs over that region. And by that way, what happened in the Arctic gets compensated for. Now, in terms of actual mechanism, what happens is that in tropical Pacific, there are so-called convective margins. There are these areas which are incredibly sensitive to very small perturbations in sea surface temperatures or in wind fields or in pressure. So even when a very weak signal arrives from the Arctic due to the changes in sea ice loss, and this is what happens in our simulation, so just a really weak signal, very small change in temperature arrives to the tropics. But this is sufficient to trigger change in convection over this convective margin region. So we then have a large-scale cloud cover changes. That is the first step of teleconnection. Then once this had happened, then these changes in the amount of convection basically trigger a wave-like motion, like a wave train of high and low pressure areas. And one such high pressure area ends up landing just there in the North Pacific off the west coast of the United States. And that's very similar like the ridge we saw during the last drought. So as I explained for the case of the previous drought, once that ridge is there, once that high pressure area is there, that means that California will be dry because all the winter storms will go further north.
It's like a chain of events.
Yes, it's really a two-step teleconnection. This series of events happen. So California is not influenced directly from the Arctic, but through the tropics.
Now, the four-year drought in California ended in the very wet winter of 2016-2017. Was there a change in the Arctic sea ice signal, or was it La Nina, or what?
Oh, I just have to clarify. So our study did not attempt to explain the previous drought. Our findings are really, really similar to previous droughts. So I can use it as an example when describing what has happened in our simulations. But basically what we did was to compare two sets of simulations with different ice extents. But those ice extents, well, first ice extent was similar to the conditions we had at the beginning of the century. And the second set of simulations had seasonally ice-free Arctic, so Arctic that is free of ice in the summer. And this is something that will probably occur in the next 2 to 3 decades. So this is predicted to happen by the mid-century. So basically, we're comparing conditions at the beginning of century and at mid-century. And as a difference between these two simulations, we see a situation in which a ridge that atmospheric pressure area in the North Pacific is more common, and California is drier. But our study does not prove that most recent drought is due to sea ice, because as you can see, the sea ice extents we use to force our model are not the one corresponding to the years of drought. So this is, could be a really interesting step for the future research. But as it is now, we did not prove that sea ice had played a role in the most recent drought. And I would be very interested to find out if it did or not.
But it might play a role in future drought.
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Well, now, listening to the media, we thought California's rain or lack of it was determined by El Nino or La Nina. Who were the first scientists to suggest that Arctic sea ice could be involved?
So I believe these were Lisa Sloan and Jacob Siebel. There was a study published in 2005 by these two scientists, and they were the first ones, as far as I know, to show that changes in Arctic sea ice cover could lead to precipitation changes over California. I think that their paper and their study did not get the attention it deserved. I think this was quite a breakthrough paper. If I try to guess why it didn't get the attention it deserved, I'm thinking it's because at the time maybe the view that Arctic can influence California felt to be in opposition with the more traditional view about, as you mentioned, El Nino or La Nina, or basically that California's precipitation variability is driven from the tropics. So I think it may have looked at that time that it's either Arctic or the tropics, and of course, scientific community agreed that it was tropics because that was the main view for so many years. So what may be helpful now is that we have shown that Arctic influences California through the tropics. So this Arctic hypothesis does not have to be in opposition with tropical hypothesis. Although I'm sure there's still been a lot of debates and different kinds of criticism, and hopefully we can advance our understanding through those.
I'll put a link to that 2005 paper in my blog so that listeners can find it and look through it. I wanted to ask you, why are you most interested in, quote, the fast atmospheric response to sea ice changes in the first decades after the sea ice loss has occurred?
Well, I think like it's just there are different modeling approaches that we can have to investigate these questions. And there were a couple of studies published recently that looked at the response one century after the loss of sea ice. I agree that that's an interesting question, but we were just thinking that maybe at this time, for some planning purposes, it may be very interesting to understand what happens sooner than that, what happens almost immediately after the sea ice loss. So something that is closer in the future as opposed to that far in the future. And that also affects the type of model you will use to investigate the problem. So if you want to know what's going to happen on a century timescale, this is a timescale where deep ocean changes will matter a lot. So you should certainly use a fully coupled model, which also has all the deep ocean processes involved. And because we looked only at these short timescales, then in our study it was justified to use a model that doesn't take into account deep ocean changes, but only surface ocean and atmosphere.
In this paper, you focused on impacts in California between December and February. Why those months?
Those are the months when California gets most of its precipitation, although yet truth to be told, March and April could also be interesting months. But we also, you know, like this was, we got so much data out of our simulations, and you have to start somewhere. So the winter as the main rain season was very interesting to us, and this is where we saw a very strong signal. So the analysis was easier because changes that we saw were statistically significant. But I agree that this analysis should be extended to other seasons, and or at least extended into the entire rain season.
I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Ivana Sivanovic. We are talking new science, how disappearing sea ice in the Arctic could affect people much farther south, right down to California. In this paper, you've chosen to focus on California. You were educated in Europe. Ivana, will the weather there change due to declining Arctic sea ice?
Yes, we see some changes in Europe, too. They're not as strong as the ones over California. And I think if I was to focus in the future on European changes, I think I would probably perform these simulations again and maybe with slightly different model. This is because Europe is influenced also a lot by changes in the North Atlantic. And I'm not entirely sure how well those were captured in the simulations I performed. So I think if I was to try to make more definite statements about Europe, I would perform some additional simulations to confirm what we saw in the ones made so far.
You have written several papers with Ken Caldera, and you worked at the Caldera Lab at Stanford.
Correct.
I know that Ken looked into trying to save the remaining Arctic ice by spraying stratospheric sulfate aerosols. Do you personally think geoengineering could delay the disappearance of sea ice and maybe even help agriculture in California?
This topic of geoengineering is so controversial that at times I'm even afraid to talk about it because I don't want to be misunderstood. Like one of my main fears is that once we start talking about geoengineering, that people will think that then no action should be taken in terms of cutting the actual emissions. So that's one of the big fears. And then another fear is also if we speak about geoengineering, that people will think that some methods that would make a really large ecological catastrophes are acceptable. So I guess, you know, like, I think those are the two big warnings about geoengineering. Like, if one would use it, would it be possible to use it in some conscious way? Would it be possible? Actually, would it be possible? That would be the first question. Would it actually have any impact, any good impact? Would it not have bad consequences? Would there be such method that would not harm the ecosystems? And would this be seen as then as a reason not to cut down emissions, which would be a bad thing? So there are lots of ethical constraints. I did perform in my career some geoengineering simulations because I was interested how the system responds to these types of forcings. I saw them in partly just like some idealized experiments, not necessarily like something one should do. I heard of a really nice geoengineering experiment happening in Siberian tundra in which one scientist is trying to bring more grazing animals so that permafrost would again become covered with certain type of vegetation which could protect it longer. I think that kind of geoengineering could be a nice geoengineering because it's ecosystem friendly. It's not disrupting the things around it. I also heard of idea that one could just, during a very cold month, spray more water over the existing sea ice and then make sea ice thicker, which would then possibly make it last longer. So this is obviously not something that could be done too large scale, but maybe over some chosen areas where you want to maintain sea ice longer for polar bears, maybe in the future, something like that is possible. But yeah, I'm not so optimistic in any sort of way about spraying the atmosphere. I just don't have a good opinion about that approach.
I share your concerns. You know, it's a very difficult topic. I'm curious, does the work that you're doing and this paper have any relationship with the studies done by Jennifer Francis at Rutgers on sea ice loss and the way that changes the jet stream?
I'm really loved the work that Jennifer Francis has performed. I'm sorry that their work encountered some harsh criticism at certain times, and I think that's a bit unfair because when you're first to suggest something, then it's natural that other people should just build on it. That they discovered, they saw something new, they told the scientific community, here this is, look, this is interesting, this should be investigated further. They suggested one possible explanation, and then it just somehow blew up. And I think that was not fair to them. That was the first study, and being first is not easy. I didn't perform analysis in my simulations that would show whether the jet had become wavier or not, like suggested in their study. I would like to do that in the future and find this out. So far, things I saw in my study did not contradict Jennifer, Francis, and Stephen Vavros suggested in their paper.
And you have had an interest in past abrupt climate changes. Do you personally think we could experience another abrupt climate change, say within 100 years or so? Is that possible at all?
I think it's possible. I think what we are seeing now with Arctic sea ice is quite abrupt already. Yes, I think there are such tipping points in climate system. I sincerely hope we avoid them, but yeah, we are pushing the system at all so many different places, and yet there could be some very, very abrupt response by a number of those. I liked there was one discussion by Peter Humbert, who mentioned like a sleeping dragon who can be awakened by what we are doing. I think there's definitely a chance for something like that. I mean, you know, there are a couple of critical things. There is permafrost, there are ice sheets, there is obviously the sea ice. There have been some suggestions that ocean circulation could abruptly change. So yeah, there are a couple of places where some abrupt shifts could happen. I don't know if they will. I certainly hope they won't.
Yes, we all do. Now, by the time a paper has been reviewed and published, many authors are already working on a follow-up or a new project. What are you working on now?
Well, my life took just a little bit different turn recently. Privately, I became a mother, so I'm working on my son at the moment. But there are many exciting topics coming out of here, and I'm slowly getting back into all of this. But I'm not right on jumping on the next new thing. But yeah, I mean, there are many, many directions that I would like to take this into. One would be understanding whether we can somehow decipher if the sea ice loss played a role in the recent California drought. Other would be this question about California fires, whether there could be also some link. In general, like understanding precipitation over California, it is a quite tricky problem. And, you know, what we did in sea ice study was basically we just took one element of that problem. We just showed what the sea ice does, but there are these multiple factors. So for the overall answer of what's going to happen in the future in California, you need to consider other factors than the sea ice. And those other factors may offset or may make stronger what the sea ice is doing. And that's also something that I would be very interested in doing. Then it would be great to perform our simulations with different models. And so there's really tons of ideas. Ideas are not missing, just the time.
From the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, we've been speaking with scientist Ivana Sivanovic. She's the lead author of a new paper called Future Loss of Arctic Sea Ice Cover Could Drive a Substantial Decrease in California's Rainfall. Find links to that paper and other things we've talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Ivana, thank you so much for helping us out here on the program.
Sure, thank you for having me here. This was lots of fun.
Radio EcoShock.
One of the most popular YouTube channels explaining climate change was suddenly shut down by YouTube in the last week or two, wiping out hundreds of climate videos and 4 years' worth of work. It's the second time that has happened this year for the Climate State channel. I'm not technically expert enough to explain it all, but I do know this. If you explore climate change on the net, you will find an overwhelming and constant flow of climate denial videos and climate confusers. Here's a tip on that. To find out about climate, use the search term climate change and not global warming. The real anti-science uploaders love the term global warming, which scientists left behind a few years ago. We can picture the possible sources of that wave of denial videos. There are real believers out there, individuals who convince themselves that tens of thousands of scientists around the world are all part of a conspiracy by communists, Jews, the Pope, leftists, fill in the blank. Some of them make money with their videos, as they fulfill a human need to deny what could cost us money or a lifestyle we like. Beyond those prolific individuals, there are professional deniers who make a good living, right up to millions of dollars, through selling products or directly from money paid by fossil fuel companies, electric utilities, and others. Some petrostates hire bot farms or workers to just keep uploading climate denier videos every day. They hope to persuade you that most people don't believe in climate change, which is the opposite of the truth. The Climate State Channel tried to counteract this constant negative flow with science-based videos. It sounds like Google didn't like their rate of uploading or something. The Climate State Channel is back for now. Louise, a regular Radio EcoShock listener, wrote me about that shutdown, and we began a dialogue, and I'll select some of that now. Louise wrote, "They reinstated it last night. Are we seeing the beginnings of censorship? I've noted in the last 6 months that it is more difficult to find recorded lectures or presentations of recent published papers on the issue of climate change, and I find this unsettling. The other concern is the removal of net neutrality rules in the USA. How robust and resilient is the archive of the information and knowledge we have of climate change? If the web were to go away or be severely censored, would it be equivalent to the burning of the libraries of Alexandria in ancient times?" So I replied, "I've given the topic of disappearing knowledge some thought. For example, if an electromagnetic pulse were exploded in the atmosphere high above the United States, it's possible the whole net could go down, at least for a while. It's my understanding there are just a couple of major server hubs who route all the traffic for the whole world. The internet was designed to overcome a nuclear attack and its methods of distribution, but over time that hasn't been watched over with enough duplicate services, in my opinion. However, various countries could still be able to remount a lot of it. Coordination between authoritarian regimes bent on climate denialism would be another matter, but even here, there are possibilities for local nets that would be difficult to stamp out entirely. There's also the possibility of a collapse of civilization, in which our information society falls back to scattered agricultural pursuits, or people become so angry with the past they no longer wish to hear anything from it. As part of my concern, the back programs for Radio EcoShock are on two servers on two continents. I hope there are also a few people who download every program and burn them to DVDs. I have noticed a couple of collectors out there. The disappearance of communications may have other causes. In the period 2006 to 2012, I went around recording authors on tour promoting their books. I rebroadcast their speeches in Vancouver on a different program, and that's still archived on my site as the Brown Bagger Recordings. But those public speeches dribbled off. Publishers could no longer afford the book tours, they said, and they switched to online videos, the art of public speaking, where the audience could participate, ask questions, laugh, or gasp. It was dying. Things change. I don't know if the universities or scientific institutions are cash-strapped or just lazy these days, but it's possible there are fewer presentations to download. I'd be interested in your thoughts on that and experiences. On that last point about universities, Louise replied, "My sense is there are fewer presentations of fresh research. I saw a flurry during COP this year, always at the American Geophysical Union. I see a lot of rehashing of research that has been out there for several years, lectures where people just repackage and explain the older information in a different way. I believe we are starting to see a roll-off in the papers and new research being published on the issue of climate change. The funding has drastically dried up, and climate change researchers are frightened for their careers in the U.S. And I might add, think of the student loans most of these young researchers are carrying in the U.S. They cannot afford to be without an income. The stakes are very high for them." Louise sent me some great links on all this, including climate grant slashing, scientists afraid to speak, the words climate change left out of grants. I'll post those links in my blog for this week's show at ecoshock.org. So I have asked a couple of European climate researchers about defunding and discouragement of American climate science, and they said basically, one, research is so far advanced and advancing in Europe that a new wave of climate information is coming. There is no defunding there. And two, the Chinese. Now, I can verify this. I get a science alert service. They send up to 100 items daily. It's a bit of a chore looking through for the gems. But more and more, I'm finding Chinese authors as either the lead author or the whole team. They've developed some excellent scientists, and apparently they believe climate change poses a serious threat to China. My only fear is that the Chinese culture is so old, so huge, so self-sufficient, and plus the language barrier, that not all the best Chinese science will reach the international community in time. I expect a new subset of science where European language experts pour through Chinese research, translating and communicating from that pool. We'll see. And then we have a new science on disinformation blogs, which relates to the need for constant refreshing of climate videos to counteract the constant flow of disinformation via the net. Jeffrey A. Harvey of the Netherlands Institute of Ecology and his colleagues published this paper November 29th in Bioscience, the Journal of the American Institute for Biological Sciences. The title is Internet Blogs, Polar Bears, and Climate Change Denial by Proxy. The press release for the study says, quote, Harvey and his colleagues performed an analysis of 45 climate denier blogs, noting that 80% relied primarily on a single denier blog for their evidence, which itself had a single author who has neither conducted any original research nor published any articles in the peer-reviewed literature on polar bears. This particular study was on polar bears. This paucity of expertise and evidence is common among such blogs, say the authors, as are personal attacks against researchers and attempts to misstate the extent of scientific uncertainty about crucial issues. Such narrowly framed attacks are designed to generate keystone dominoes, say the authors, which deniers can then use as proxies for climate science as a whole. By appearing to knock over the keystone domino, audiences targeted by the communication may assume all other dominoes are toppled in the form of dismissal by association. That's a quote regarding a new paper on climate denial blogs. Find a link in my show blog at ecoshock.info. If you would like to add to this discussion, just tag it on as a comment to the show's blog. It may take a couple of hours for your comment to show up, but unless it's illegal or downright stupid, it will be posted. Thank you so much for being there, and please join me again next week for more of the Science of the Future on Radio EcoShock.